Hey listeners, if you're working on a manuscript, we'd love to help. Email us about our novel mentorship program at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
Okay, it's your turn, so tell us about your story.
I picked the story A Small Good Thing by Raymond Carver. She pulled into the driveway and cut the engine. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the wheel for a minute. She listened to the ticking sounds the engine made as it began to cool. Then she got out of the car. She could hear the dog barking inside the house. She went to the front door, which was unlocked. She went inside and turned on lights and put on a kettle of water for tea. She opened some dog food and fed Slug on the back porch. The dog ate in hungry little smacks. It kept running into the kitchen to see that she was going to stay. As she sat down on the sofa with her tea, the telephone rang. Yes, she said as she answered. Hello? Mrs. Weiss, a man's voice said. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and she thought she could hear machinery or equipment of some kind in the background. Yes, what is it? She said. This is Mrs. Weiss. This is she. What is it, please? She listened to whatever it was in the background. Is it Scotty, for Christ's sake? Scotty, the man's voice said. It's about Scotty, yes. It has to do with Scotty, that problem. Have you forgotten about Scotty? The man said. Then he hung up. She dialed the hospital's number and asked for the third floor. She demanded information about her son from the nurse who answered the telephone. Then she asked to speak to her husband. It was, she said, an emergency. She waited, turning the telephone cord in her fingers. She closed her eyes and felt sick at her stomach. She would have to make herself eat. Slug came in from the back porch and lay down near her feet. He wagged his tail. She pulled at his ear while he licked her fingers. Howard was on the line. Somebody just called here, she said. She twisted the telephone cord. He said it was about Scotty, she cried. Scotty's fine, Howard told her. I mean, he's still sleeping. There's been no change. The nurse has been in twice since you've been gone. A nurse or else a doctor. He's all right. This man called. He said it was about Scotty, she told him. Honey, you rest for a little while. You need to rest. It must be that same caller I had. Just forget it. Come back down here after you've rested. Then we'll have breakfast or something. Breakfast, she said. I don't want any breakfast. You know what I mean, he said. Juice. Something. I don't know. I don't know anything. Anne. Jesus, I'm not hungry. Jesus, I'm not hungry either. Anne, it's hard to talk now. I'm standing here at the desk. Dr. Francis is coming again at 8 o'clock this morning. He's going to have something to tell us then. Something more definite. That's what one of the nurses said. She didn't know any more than that. Anne, honey, maybe we'll know something more then. At 8 o'clock. Come back here before 8. Meanwhile, I'm right here and Scotty's all right. He's still the same, he added. I was drinking a cup of tea, she said, when the telephone rang. They said it was about Scotty. There was a noise in the background. Was there a noise in the background on that call you had, Howard? I don't remember, he said. Maybe the driver of the car. Maybe he's a psychopath and found out about Scotty somehow. But I'm here with him. Just rest like you were going to do. Take a bath and come back by 7 or so, and we'll talk to the doctor together when he gets here. It's going to be all right, honey. I'm here, and there are doctors and nurses around. They say his condition is stable. I'm scared to death, she said.
Had you read this one before you suggested it?
No, actually, let me pull this up. The reason I suggested it is I found this thing where George Saunders is suggesting stories. Like, everyone should read these stories. But he's basically like, here's some great stories you should read. And he mentioned Raymond Carver's A Small Good Thing. And the kind of description he said, it was in a list. He's like, here's three more stories you should read. And in each, I'm going to quote this, in each, the reader is led to a comfortable place of harshness where writer and reader conspire to dislike/look down upon a character. Then comes the reversal. The reader finds he has wrongly sided with intolerance and unkindness. This is perhaps a quintessential earthling moment when we find that we have underestimated one of our fellows, etc., etc. So I just was like intrigued by that idea of like the writer making us dislike someone and then turning it around at the end. So I was like, ah, let's do that story. I read it before I sent it to you to see, because I misunderstood when I first read that. I thought it was something else. I thought it was about disliking the main character, like the point of view character. People ask that about that in the workshop all the time. Like, do we need to read to like the narrator?
Yeah.
Which my answer is always no, we don't need to. That's like a different question. You can enjoy a story without liking the character. So I thought this was an interesting way to approach that question. It's like, you don't need to like the character. In fact, sometimes it's the writer deliberately makes you dislike a character.
Right.
And, you know, as writers, we're supposed to have all the controls. Like, we can make you like a character, make you hate a character, make you love a character. So I thought that was an interesting thing to think about this story.
It's funny to talk about a writer making you dislike someone, because this is something that we do in our daily lives, you know? We interact with a stranger and we tell ourselves we don't like that person. But I didn't force myself not to like them. I'm just getting this glimpse of them, you know? And it's something that you can like pretty easily do with any character that you don't spend a ton of time with, you know?
Dislike them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a character in passing, just the person in the grocery store that says something that you're just not, you just didn't like that little comment.
Oh,
you didn't like that little joke.
That brand?
Yeah, the person like cuts you off in traffic and
oh yeah.
The writer doesn't have to do anything to make you dislike that person.
Then
it's
you
just,
follow them home
we don't
and you
know
murder
them.
Their family.
Yeah. So obviously we don't like this baker at first, because even their initial interaction is
gruff.
Weirdly tense. Yeah.
Yeah.
He doesn't make eye contact. He's really short with her. You have to think about this being of a time when you would just place an order and they would just have to rely on the fact that you were going to be back. This is before the internet, before even voicemail, it seems like. So you're just repeatedly calling each other.
Yeah.
It just seems like this was of a time where there was a ton of room for error in terms of communication. And so, there still is. But these days it's like, you know, if I thought that I was going to miss like a cake pickup, I guarantee you there's something that I have in my email that lets me log in and pay for it.
Yeah.
Right?
The
I know
email.
I'm not going to get it, but it's paid for. Or in this case, it's hard to imagine that he didn't take payment up front. So
Yeah,
there's like all these like things that are of its time where you wonder if this would have happened today. But either way, their initial interaction is bizarre. The story also starts that way. So we know that there's something about this baker that we're paying special attention to. It's not just the cake, it's the baker. So I immediately knew it was the baker that was repeatedly calling, right? I'd have to reread the section where they first missed the call, because it's the husband that takes it. And so that's why
that's part of it, because
totally
he didn't interact with the baker. Yeah.
Didn't interact, probably didn't even know that his wife had ordered a cake, right?
She went and ordered a cake without him, so.
Yeah. So, but, you know, being introduced to him, then we get this phone call. We know there's only one other, like, entity in the story, and it's the baker, and the only one with a chip on his shoulder in general, and now he's got a reason to be upset.
It would have been odd if the doctor were making those calls.
Yeah, hey, Scotty. And then by the end, it makes that reversal that much more
because it's bookended, right?
Yeah.
It's like, here's our introduction to the character, and then the end of the story is, here's our reintroduction to the character. But you started that off by saying we can choose to like and dislike people in real life, however like they do a thing. But that's always our interpretation of it, right?
Yeah.
You think of a story. A story is being narrated.
Yes.
A story is being presented to us. So the presentation is selecting the details. So if you notice somebody do something in traffic in the grocery store, you will take that detail and make assumptions and make feelings out of that detail. But when you're reading, someone, the author, has chosen the details they're presenting to you in order to make you feel certain ways. So it's like, they're not going to mention that this person like grabs grapes when they're going through the fruit section of the grocery store. That might make someone dislike them. They're going to mention that they're, you know, courteous or something, and then you'll like them better. But that's what I mean by like, those are the ways that we often think about it in terms of like, we borrow our feelings as readers from the characters. So if it's a first person narrator who's scared of something that's happening in the story, we'll often feel that same emotion to some degree, or at least empathize with it. That's part of fiction, is empathy, right?
Yeah.
But, and this is told in an interesting point of view where it's not a first person, it's third person, and it's removed. We're very not often in either of their perspectives. It's just kind of like standing back from things. So we're not getting their emotions, but we're still getting the details that arise from our own feeling, like that are going to encourage our own reactions to things.
Yeah. When I think about an unlikable narrator or a main character, I always think about that T.C. Boyle story of The Lie, where he's supposed to be unlikable, but we focus on him completely and there's never a reversal. And there's something interesting about a story like this. It's almost as if in order for there to be a reversal, the character that we have the bad opinion about has to be a sort of a secondary character. Because for the most part, if we're in a character's head, what fiction does is make you somehow sympathetic to that person.
It should, yeah.
Yeah, whether or not you like them, we're supposed to understand them.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, understanding is what, you know, generates any kind of affection for a character or an alliance even. You know, you're rooting for the main character because that's whose perspective perspective you're part of and whose side you're on. If this was told from the perspective of the baker, the parents would be the evil ones, right? Because we know less about them. And in his opinion, they've somehow wronged him. So I feel like reversals like this are pretty good demonstrations of what it is that fiction does well for individual characters.
Oh, yeah.
I just read a book this year. It was called Death Be Not Proud. And it was about like a 17-year-old that dies of a brain tumor, but it was written in like the 60s or something. And there was something reminiscent of this hospital scene with this young kid. And you just know that medicine is not what it is now. And so I don't know about you, but I was reading this story just sort of assuming the worst. It's almost hard to imagine that people survive some of the things that they went through. Like,
it's an interesting, because you can tell the way that the story is told, you can tell the doctors are, well, they express their confusion. He's like, all our tests are fine. He says he's fine. He should be able to wake up. He should be fine, but he's not waking up.
Yeah.
So that's the feeling. So we know as a reader, even if it wasn't separated by time or technological progression or understanding of medicine right. being better, we understand that there is a disconnect, that something is wrong with him that they do not see.
Yeah, it made me so uncomfortable to keep reading the doctor's explanation. It's not a coma. It's not a coma. It's not a coma. Well, what is it? I don't know, but it's not a coma. Every time they leave the hospital, like, bedside to go home, which I was horrified when I realized that they had a dog, even more horrified that his name was Slug, although I think that's very funny. But poor Slug's at home, like, come on, I'm gonna starve to death. You know, they didn't call a neighbor or anything. They keep leaving his bedside, and that too felt distinctly like of a certain era where if something bad does happen, you're not gonna know until you rush back, you know, unless your husband calls you in the exact moment and you pick up. So all of this felt that much more stressful and heightened. We're just out of our depth, and you just kind of like assume that things are not gonna go well. I didn't think he was gonna actually die, but
oh yeah, I don't know. I thought, so speaking to the idea of like of the time, I thought it was fascinating that he sets up this situation in which, so the baker is, whatever his motivation is for making these phone calls, he wants to like torment them in some way.
Yeah.
But he can only do it via the phone, because that's the only thing she gave him is a phone number. But he's writing the story at a time when they can be away from the phone at the hospital for a couple of days, and they only get the phone calls when they're at home. So the mechanics of this, I thought, were really interesting. Like, as the writer, he has to get them back home at least a couple of times so they can get the menacing phone calls. But most of the story is at the hospital. There's the part in the beginning setting things up. She meets the baker, makes the order. Yeah. There's the part with the kid where he gets hit. Then he collapses at home. And so then we're in the hospital for a really long time. And then there's the part where the husband goes home, gets a phone call. And then there's the part where she goes home and gets a phone call. But the rest of it's just at the hospital. So most of this takes place at the hospital. The menace is just kind of this, like, it's not quite a blink or you'll miss it kind of thing, because it's set up as being like the central thing, but it's small. It's a small part of it. And that's a function of the time and place it is. They don't have cell phones. Otherwise, every phone call would go straight to cell phone, and she would know, it would be labeled baker, right? And she'd know exactly who it was.
Right.
He doesn't have access to calling the hospital. And there's just all that stuff. Like you said before, there's no emails or anything. There's no app. There's the baker's app where you can, like, it's connected to DoorDash, so you can get it just sent to the hospital if you need to. But the mechanics of it are interesting because it limits the menace that the baker can exert. And yet it's enough. It's enough menace to drive the whole story.
It's menace enough because also following the parents, we know that this is one of those things where had they casually forgotten to pay for a cake, this would be annoying and bizarre to be getting harassed in this way. But we know that the kid is actively dying. That's why they missed it, right? It's not just that they're distracted and forgot. The cake was also for the kid. You know, all of these things combined make this baker seem that much more evil, but he's also operating just without this knowledge.
Yeah.
Or else we kind of know by the end that he would not have taken that tact at all.
Yeah. It is interesting that he didn't at the end reveal that the baker went through something. Like there was a reason that it was just some switch flipped in his brain and he lashed out. And we don't know why. There's a lot of reasons he could have done that. Like maybe he had a bad day. His wife left him that day. You work too much at the bakery. And he's like, all right, I got to make this cake for this kid. And then nobody picked it up. So he's like, ah.
Yeah. He seems like the kind of character, and I think it makes him more believable this way, that just happens to have this affect. Like he just walks around with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. And by the end, we know that he's like mostly a lonely guy, because I also liked that they didn't make some grand reveal for him. Like, oh, I also lost a son. Like, oh, who cares? Like, it doesn't need to be that for him to show grace and for them to have this moment at the end where they are comfortable in each other's presence, and he does what he does for anyone, which is feed them.
Yeah. He gets to remember why he's in the business he's in.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of times stories that feel like too on the nose, too trite, too like Hallmarky are ones that would draw a direct parallel.
Yeah.
And they're less believable, but they're also just, it makes it easy to dismiss what is core to humanity, which is not having gone through the same thing, but still being kind to other people. Yeah. I don't have to have lost a son to be kind to these people or to on some level understand them.
Yes.
We talk all the time about like fiction, and this is what it's doing with this perspective and this reversal, is creating empathy for people whose plights we've never lived. I'm reading a story about a family that lost a kid. That's never happened to me, but I can still feel something because of it, because the writer has accomplished what they set out to do, which is make me feel something. So yeah, I like that it wasn't, I've also gone through something horribly tragic.
Yeah.
No, he just checks himself in that moment and he says, all right, they're going through something. They didn't do this to piss me off. And the switch that flips in his head is not a dramatic one. It's just, oh, I messed up, you know?
Yeah. Let me see if I can write this.
Yeah. And I like how the story just sort of ends because they're just in each other's presence. He doesn't say anything that's super Hallmarky on the nose, right? He doesn't have some sweeping wisdom that he plants on them. He doesn't impose in any kind of way. He doesn't make it any more emotional than it needs to be. He just lets them stay there, right? He's kind of reading the room for the first time, and they just all three hang out pretty late into the night talking about whatever it is they talk about. And that seems to be like distraction enough or connection enough or resolution enough to this situation with the baker, at least, that there's something, you know, cathartic about it.
Yeah.
Just imagine if this was a Disney movie. You know, how insufferable this ending would be.
Well, yeah. I mean, you'd have to set up, the baker would have his own backstory. It'd be like, the first song would be about, I love baking, but I lost my son. Accidentally cooked him making bread.
And he's really mad about it. Like, okay, dude.
It's interesting how the point of view intersects with all that, because it is such a psychically removed point of view. We do get kind of, okay, so I should say this about point of view. Like, there are descriptions of what she's feeling and what her husband's feeling that are technically internal. It's like, she felt this. And a lot of times they're metaphorical or even a simile. It's like, she felt as if the whole world, blah, blah, blah. I don't remember. I should have marked them or have an example ready. But it's not a internal view. It's not like she could feel her heart clenching. You know, she could feel a wash of despair or whatever. It's very external kind of perspective on an internal feeling, if that makes sense. And I think that's why it's done with metaphor, and that's why it's not done physiologically. It's done literally, I should say, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I was trying to think of something else to comment on, and we haven't really talked about like the other family that she interacts with, but there's another family that's waiting for news in the hospital of their son, and it's a black family.
Franklin.
Yeah. And that also felt like this opportunity for the main character, this family, to identify with someone else and to connect with another family that's going through the exact same thing. And it seems similar to the baker, right? She like desperately wants to connect with this family while they're waiting, and I think she struggles to do it. And then at one point she comes back and says, yeah, my kid too. It feels like a bizarre, like sort of fumbling attempt.
Well, it's again, being human, and part of being human is like trying to connect. This is why the interactions with the baker are so, his interactions with them are so menacing, is because he's not connecting in the way that you want human beings to connect, right?
Yeah.
And even the doctors, like the doctor showed up, it looked like he had just come from a concert, I think is the line at one point. Like, he doesn't feel fully present sometimes, and he's not dismissive. He does seem genuinely concerned about things, but he's not seeing things clearly. There's this other family, she wants to connect with them. They see things clearly.
Right.
But she's so lost in the moment, she can't look beyond it. So she has a hard time connecting with them, even though she can sense that there is a connection that could be made.
Yeah. I mean, she's obviously drawn to them because she sees them in active, open, obvious grief, but she doesn't talk to them until they think that she's like a nurse. And it seemed like this like sort of like level playing field that probably just speaks to, like you said, the empathy overall, that we're supposed to see all of these people going through their own private separate griefs and without having to even discuss it, to feel some kind of not camaraderie, but you can recognize that in other people and just kind of appreciate it differently when you're also going through it. I like that this other family, you know, didn't pat this woman on the hand and give her a hug either.
Well, she was also trapped in her own grief, her own worry. So she couldn't really connect. Like, she sees Anne. And what's her first assumption? She's got to be here about Franklin, because that's what I'm thinking about.
Right.
And so Anne sees her and it's like, oh, no, I'm just looking for the elevator. Because she's not really thinking about her either. She's just thinking about herself. So it's like they're not looking outward, but then they're forced to.
Right.
Which is so, I mean, that's how people work.
Yeah. I didn't think that this was necessarily a study in everyone's going through something. Be kind to the mean baker. He's going through something too. I don't think that was the message. It was something much less preachy and much more real, which is just that, yeah, unless you take a half a second, you're going to make an assumption about someone.
Well, it's called a small good thing. And the baker says that at the end to describe giving them the rolls, giving them the little cinnamon rolls. And it's like, I can't really help you, but this is a small thing and it's good.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's what everything that happens, they're just small things. Even the little connection between her and Franklin's family, it's just a small thing, but they're all human things. I mean, ultimately, whether or not you write deliberate messages into your fiction, like this is my intended meaning, you know, this kind of high-minded stuff, you're basically trying to say in any story, hey, this is what people are like. This is what human beings are like. This is what it's like to be human. Here's another example. And then you present your example. And then this one, the example is people try to connect.
Right.
It's good. It's a small thing, but it's good.
I'm trying to think like what my takeaway for this story is. I don't know. I think I'm just piggybacking off kind of what you started off with this like reversal. But I feel like I've said this about fiction as long as I've done these workshops and things, which is that the best writers are empathetic people, and the best writing makes you think about what it's like to be someone else. And how did this story accomplish it except for make a very startling reversal? He makes someone seem like a bad guy doing a bad thing at the wrong time, and he's really not a bad guy, and he didn't really do this horrible, horrible thing. He wouldn't have done it had he realized the context. And so by the end, he doesn't seem so evil. And I don't have empathy in terms of thinking, oh, this poor baker, he made a mistake. It's just like I said, we just make assumptions about strangers all day. It's what keeps us safe. It's what, you know, allows us to have interactions. You see someone that looks like they're in a bad mood, you're not gonna harass them. And you see someone that looks like they're in a good mood and you kind of assume they're a good person. And it's human to make these assumptions too. It's not a flawed thing to get a creepy call from the baker and assume that he's a bad guy. I mean, you should be careful. You should drive to the bakery with your husband and make sure that you're doing this right, because you don't know what you're about to get into. But yeah, it's probably just like a decent reminder of the ways that we can be kind to each other too. I don't know what kind of a takeaway that is, except that I think if you know and understand people and like people as a writer, if you actually like other people as a writer, it's what makes you a good writer. I don't think there's ever been a great writer who goes into fiction and thinks to himself, I hate everyone. Everyone sucks.
They might hate everyone in their daily life, but when they sit down and they like put them on the page, I mean, that's like the essence of writing. Like you said earlier, is like you have to empathize. In order to create a character on the page, you have to empathize with that character's experience to some degree so that you can help the reader empathize with that character. And if you don't, it's not going to work.
Yeah, they won't be believable people. If the baker had just been on this page as evil, 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 it would feel like a Disney villain. And even Disney villains have backstories that brought them to that place, you know? Because otherwise they're just caricatures of evil incarnate.
Just on that line, this also demonstrates you don't need backstory. You just show the character doing stuff and we get a sense of who they are and how to feel about them. We don't have to know their childhood every time. Sometimes I think we make this assumption that a person is who they are because of their life experience. So in order to explain who they are, we have to explain their life experience. That's not true.
Yeah.
The person is who they are, and the life experience might inform that, but who they are also informs the experiences they're going to have. Like, are they going to feel happy about what happened in traffic? Are they going to feel grumpy about it because of what they are? So we don't need to know about what happened in traffic, but we can see how they are from what they're doing now.
The same way that, like, these parents are not going to change drastically in terms of how they approach the world necessarily. You could see a story where, like, because their son died in a random car crash, they become just hardened to the world and cynical, whatever. That, yes, that could be a thing. But you could also probably argue that they were that way before. Yeah, so it's not always, like you said, we don't need to know what happened. There's also like an essence of a person that exists outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, personality is kind of the way in which a person interprets their own experience through their own personality, so that they react in ways that are dictated by their personality. Like, we make really brusque kind of categories. Like, are you a pessimist or an optimist? But, you know, there's a lot of nuance in that, or can be, but that's not a thing that has to be informed by childhood trauma, right? That we need to go into. On the other hand, I mean, sometimes it's important to know those things for a story so that you can know, like, this person's afraid of water because their brother drowned, you know, whatever.
Right. What's your takeaway, John?
My takeaway is kind of related to what I was saying about the point of view and how the emotions are expressed, but it's just kind of just the way that this is written overall, the narration of it is so fascinating. It's got a style that I feel like, I don't know if it's out of fashion or it's just not as prevalent. Like, I think of that Cheever story we read has a kind of style like this.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. It absolutely does. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a kind of like quick sentences, but it's amazing how these sentences are short. The story is relatively longish, not super long, but it's...
It was a decent length.
Yeah. It reads very quickly because of that.
It does.
But it also, it lingers in everything. Like, things that happen, they happen slowly on the page. She's deciding to go home, right? And it says, she stood in her coat for a minute, trying to recall the doctor's exact words, looking for any nuances, any hint of something behind his words other than what he had said. She tried to remember if his expression had changed any when he bent over to examine the child. She remembered the way his features had composed themselves as he rolled back the child's eyelids and then listened to his breathing. She went to the door, where she turned and looked back. She looked at the child, and then she looked at the father. Howard nodded. She stepped out of the room and pulled the door closed behind her. This is like, she's decided to go home, but she's like waiting. She's taking a moment. You could write that as she hesitated. After a moment, she left the room. But we're actually taking that moment. We're actually living through the hesitation. Or like, what is she hesitating about? She's replaying what the doctor did. So it's slow in that way. Not slow in its overall effect, if that makes sense. But just like lingering in that.
I think that's a good example to sort of what we touched on with the baker. It's, we don't need to know his backstory. We don't need description of how he is. We just need to see him doing things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a scene where she's just doing it.
Yes. And we get her internal emotions out of that. I don't need to describe it. And Carver doesn't need to describe it from this point of view either. She doesn't want to leave the room. So she's like looking around for an excuse not to.
Yeah.
But she can't find one. And so then she leaves. But the whole thing's written like that, which is just, I think it's such a good way to present a story. I often talk about flow. Like, when I give advice on prose, like, I talk about how, like, you establish a topic and you want each sentence to, like, if you want to change topics, like, sentences need to shift the topic naturally between them or amongst them. So, like, the beginning of a paragraph, if you establish one thing, you don't want to, like, forget about it in the middle and then come back to it at the end. You want to keep that together so that we know where we're focusing on.
Right.
And one way to do that is with sentences like this, where you have just short sentences that kind of, like, here's what she's looking at, here's what she's looking at, here's what she's looking at, here's what, so we can follow her train of thought. Not literally, we're not getting her train of thought, we're just seeing what's being focused on in each moment or in each sentence.
I've been working on my book more lately, and I've been working on it a lot, and I realize that I have a horrible habit of contextualizing all of these characters doing things to tell you what it is they're doing and why. And it becomes this like really labored writing process, but I imagine like an even worse reading experience. So your pointing that out is helpful because, like you said, there can still be all of the emotion you intend to impart on the reader. It's not absent because you haven't articulated it. If you've focused on almost like the blocking of the scene, it can also come across, especially if you've done elements of what I'm describing I do all the time in other sections, right? It's not all or nothing. It's just not every time.
Yeah. They do touch on emotions, even in this kind of thing. Like, there's this other part where it says, Howard sat in the chair next to her chair. They looked at each other. He wanted to say something else and reassure her, but he was afraid too. He took her hand and put it in his lap, and this made him feel better, her hand being there. He picked up her hand and squeezed it. Then he just held her hand. They sat like that for a while, watching the boy and not talking. From time to time, he squeezed her hand. Finally, she took her hand away. It talks about being afraid, and it talks about feeling reassured, which are both emotions, which are both feelings that we just given to us. But we feel them more strongly in the way he's like touching her and the way that they're sitting together.
Right.
So you can mention the emotions to kind of like give us a, I don't know, like to give us the topic. This is, he's addressing his fear.
You can like point us in a direction or something.
Yeah. There's a concern sometimes you feel in writing prose is whether you're presenting something that's abstract or something that's concrete. Like if you say that like they went outside and started fighting, that's really abstract. Like, what does that look like? But if you said they went outside and without warning, or without warning is even a little abstract, but like as he turned, he swung his fist at the side of his head, right? That's a specific way to start a fight that's a little more concrete. So a lot of times emotions feel abstract, like he felt afraid.
Right.
Like, what is that? That's really abstract. And that's why we want more concrete, non-abstract details. But it's okay to have those little abstractions if they're realized in a concrete way, if that makes sense. Anyway, all of that is my takeaway.
Anyway. All right. Thanks, guys. If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at napleswritersworkshop.com.